I want to start hour number two by continuing our conversation about the Masters. Quite a weekend at Augusta. We are joined by a longtime golf writer, a contributor to Golf Digest, the recipient of 11 first place awards from the Golf Writers Association of America. He is a partner at the Fire Pit Collective. He is the author of 6 different books. He is Alan Shipnuck. Alan, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Romy. Thanks for having me.
Always good to talk to you, Alan. Thanks so much. Now, you started off your piece for Golf Digest with the fact that Hideki Matsuyama drives a minivan, and he is so private that nobody even knew he was married until well after the fact. Let me start right there. What is your sense of who this guy is and what he's all about?
Well, I mean, he's a golf obsessive. He lives the game. I mean, he's often the last guy at the range. He has a gift, and he's dedicated his whole life to realizing his potential. And there's very few distractions in his life, despite the fact he's an icon in Japan. I mean, he does not live like a rock star. He doesn't see himself that way. He's hyper-focused on being a great golfer. And so he has this dichotomy in his life where when he's in Japan, he's one of the biggest athletes over there. When he comes to the U.S., he can kind of do his thing. He uses the language barrier as a shield. You know, he actually speaks better English than he lets on, but that means he doesn't have to interact with American reporters and anyone at the tournament he doesn't want to deal with, and he's in a little bit of a cocoon. So he's just a bit of a golf terminator, and he's fun to watch. I mean, he smashes the ball, and he has a little bit of a swagger, but there's also sort of that reflexive respect that he brings to what he's doing, and you know the image of his caddy bowing to the golf course at the end. That was a graceful end note to the win, and so it's kind of a nice mix of East and West. And but he's one hell of a player, and this was not a shock. I mean, he's been building towards this for a long time.
A great moment, very good explanation too. Alan Shipnuck is joining us. You know, before we talk about what went down on Sunday and what that means, go back to Saturday for a minute, Alan, if you don't mind. The way he played the back nine on Saturday, in your mind, where does that rank among the all-time great Saturday back nine performances at Augusta?
Yeah, it's right up there. You know, that it's an underrated thing of various, you know, great champions have taken control of the tournament, sort of grabbed it by its throat on Saturday afternoon. I mean, Dustin did it just last year with a bogeyless 65, but you know, Nicklaus and Hogan and Seve and Tiger, they've all had some epic Saturdays that really allowed them to cruise in the final round, and that was Hideki's blueprint. I mean, the weather came in and the course changed. It would have been so brick hard, the greens, the first 2 days. And the players are mostly playing defense out there. The rains came, and there was a little delay. And when they got back out on the golf course, most players were still in that mindset. But Hideki just started attacking. And because the greens are a little more receptive and because his ball striking was just so precise, you know, he went on that tear, shot 30 on the back nine to open up a 4-stroke lead. And that was really the key sort of 2 hours of the whole tournament, was the way he just took control on Saturday evening.
Alan Shipnuck is joining us. Salen, what about Sunday? You know, he's grinding it out, and he's stringing together pars. Nobody else is making a move at all. How do you explain what happened to everybody else and the fact that outside of Xander Schauffele, nobody really made a run at Hideki?
Yeah, and Schauffele did come until after he completely, I was going to say a bad word, after he completely went sideways on the front nine, you know, 4, 5, and 6. He was 4 over par in a 3-hole span, and it was like, okay, now he's giving the tournament away. He can freewheel it and start making birdies. And as soon as he got close, he dumped it in the water on 16. I mean, it was such a weird round. It was the most unlikely even par 72 you'll ever see out of Schauffele with a double and a triple. But, you know, Augusta just gets in these guys' heads. I mean, you've seen it from whether it's Johnny Miller or it's Ernie Els or it's Greg Norman. There's a long list of great champions whose games, you know, more recently Rory McIlroy, their games seem tailor-made to this golf course, but it just puts them on edge. Part of it is they want it too much. It's the most coveted tournament there is, with all, you know, the Southern fried traditions and all that stuff that people seem to take way too seriously. But it's just the most risk-reward golf course there is. And you're walking on a knife's edge the whole time. You know, a couple yards makes a huge difference going into those greens between having an easy birdie look and getting ejected. And it just... it short circuits these guys' brains. I mean, there's no other way to explain what happened to Justin Thomas this year, who's coming off a huge win at the Players' Championship and was playing great. And he makes an eight out of the middle of fairway, you know, to basically, you know, remove himself from the proceedings. And that happened again. I mean, the conditions were not as tough on Sunday as they've been on Thursday and Friday. But everyone who you cared about, who was in the hunt, was going backwards. Whether it was Jordan Spieth or it was Justin Rose, you know, Schauffele on the front nine. And, you know, they just couldn't get it done. You know, whether it's mental or physical, these guys just cannot handle the golf course on Sunday. And you see it year after year at the Masters. That's part of what, you know, it just messes with their mind. That's what makes it such a great tournament course. And it did allow Matsuyama just to kind of cruise around. And then he got hot there at the turn, you know, with, you know, birdieing 8 and 9. And all of a sudden he's in A-man corner leading by 6. And it was like, it was a pretty boring Sunday. There was just a few moments of drama when Schauffele made his run, but as soon as he hit it into the water on 16, and you know, that just allowed Matsuyama to play prevent defense the rest of the way.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I hated to see that, Alan Shipnuck. I think he'll bounce back from it, but that's going to sting. That's going to leave a mark. Now, you had a fascinating piece for Golf Digest over the weekend about what happens right after somebody wins the Masters and the ceremony and the procedures that follow. As an example, we all see the event in Butler Cabin, but what is Butler Cabin really like? For instance, how big is it?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's 4 bedrooms with a bunch of bathrooms. That's on kind of the floor you walk into. Down below, it's the whole TV studio. And I've sneaked into the cabin a few times, which is actually got banned from the Masters in 2013. And that's a story for another day. But you know, it's
no, it's not, inside. Dude. That's a story for any day, including this day.
Yeah, well, you know, my job is to take readers places they can't go, and so I'd been in the cabin with Zach Johnson in 07 and wrote about it, skated off that one. And in 2012, I walked in with Bubba Watson and his people, and one of the officials asked me to leave because he just recognized me. But at that point, Bubba was in a cart on his way to the cabin to be reunited with his family, and I needed that scene for my story, so I took the long way out of the cabin by way of one of the bathrooms and just kind of hung out for a while. And then I heard a huge cheer, just how I knew Bubba had arrived, and I did a fake flush, and I opened the door, but the general manager of Augusta National was standing there, and he was pissed.
Wow.
And I got escorted off the grounds, but it was worth it because of the cover story. It had some great scenes from the cabin, but yeah, I mean, the cabin itself isn't much. I would describe the style as, you know, southern masculine. It's all, you know, dark wood and plaid, but it's just the aura about it that's cool. And there's about 15 or 20 minutes where after the green jacket ceremonies, indoor and outdoor, after the press conferences, they bring the champ back to see his family and his loved ones. And it's really their first time to enjoy it. It's the first time they've seen him wearing the blazer in person, and it's quite emotional, and that's been the backdrop for a few of my SI cover stories. But and then from there, they all go and have dinner with the green jackets, you know, with the whole membership, and it's quite a sight. You know, I walked in with Zach and his family, and you know, it's just a room full of old white guys in green jackets, and it's quite a scene. And they have this very formal dinner, and the champ is you know, he's the man of the hour, so a lot of the members were among the most powerful people in the world are coming over and shaking his hand and reliving the day. And it's one of those Augusta traditions that happens out of the public eye, but it certainly means a lot to the players and something they never forget.
It actually sounds pretty awesome and pretty unique. Alan Shipnuck joining us. What happened when Phil Mickelson was there and wanted to raid the wine cellar?
All right. So this is in 2004 when Phil, you know, long awaited breakthrough. He made that walk-off birdie. It's the greatest moment of his career. And so, you know, Phil's he's an oenophile. He loves his wines. And the cellar at Augusta National is legendary. I mean, it's one of the best in the world. And they buy the futures on all the best Bordeaux and all these great wines. And they have many bottles that they're into the thousands of dollars and some into the tens of thousands of dollars. And so Phil tells Hootie Johnson, the then chairman, he's like, "Hootie, I just won the Masters. I want to celebrate. You know, go deep into the cellar and bring me the best stuff you got." And you know, unlike the champions dinner on Tuesday night, the club provides the food and the drinks for the Sunday night dinner. So, you know, it's the defending champion pays for the dinner on Tuesday night, but that's not the case on right when you won on Sunday. And so, so Phil gets pulled away to do something, but his wife, Amy, is kind of lingering. She's the one who told me the story. And she hears Hootie say to one of his lieutenants, do be sure that Mr. Mickelson has presented the wine bill tonight. And, so I was trying to get a number on how deep they took it, but Amy said, I think we probably, you know, we definitely broke even or more, you know, the first place.
Broke even.
Yeah, for a million plus. She's like, it's okay, we got to keep the jacket, it's all good. So I think she was exaggerating. But yeah, no doubt, there was a lot of good wine that was drained out of the cellar that night.
That's such a good story. Big boy getting after it. All right, so really quickly, what is the significance of Hideki's win mean for the game of golf globally?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, with the Olympics in Tokyo, he's the first Japanese man to win a major championship. He's only the second man from Asia. Wai Yang, of course, was the first in 2009, but that was somewhat flukish, and Yang just faded away. Whereas Matsuyama's only 29, and he's going to be a force for a long time. So he is now going to loom over these Olympics like, you know, Godzilla marching through the high rises of Tokyo. Like there's a lot of talk now. He's going to be the one that gets to light the cauldron, which is a huge honor for the home country, whichever athlete is chosen. And, you know, golf is very tenuous in the games. It came back in Rio, and a bunch of the top players didn't go because they're afraid of getting a mosquito bite. And they brought much shame to the sport by not showing up when every other athlete in the world did. And even now, in the midst of a global pandemic, they're traveling the world playing golf. So it's clearly they weren't really afraid of Zika. That was just the smokescreen that a lot of them conveniently latched onto. So if the top stars keep skipping golf in the Olympics, they're going to get the sport's going to get booted out again, and like it did for 112 years previously. So that's a really strong concern within the game. But Matsuyama has kind of made all that go away. And who cares if Dustin Johnson is fishing that week? You know, Matsuyama is going to be the biggest star over there, and he's going to carry the whole thing. And if he can pull a medal to accessorize his new blazer, that's going to be a huge thing for the sport. Because while golf is not a traditional Olympic sport, what's happened is the federations throughout Asia, Latin America, other parts of the world, they've pumped tons of money into the grassroots programs because it's a pretty easy way to win a medal. You know, you can be 5'4" like Ryan Harmon. You don't have to be a physical specimen to win a medal in golf. And so a lot of these sort of second-tier countries see it as a path to increase their medal count. So as long as golf is in the Olympics, the game is going to grow in places where it really hasn't before. That helps everyone. It helps pay Dustin Johnson's endorsement deals. All the product that TaylorMade moves throughout the world, it goes right in his pocket, yet he won't even show up to play. So it's very disappointing, sort of the myopia of the game's top stars who have skipped the Olympics. And that's why Matsuyama being there, being the Masters champ, being the Master of Ceremonies is so monumental for golf in these Olympics.
Well said, right? Like DJ is thinking, why do I have to go? I'm getting paid anyway to sit right here. Listen, I mentioned off the top that you're a partner with the Fire Pit Collective. Now, I'm a huge Fire Pit guy. Maybe it's me. I've got to think there's some kind of metaphor or analogy in there and that you're not giving up your writing to build fire pits. What exactly is this all about? How did it come to be?
Well, you know, if you go to some of the citadels of the game, whether it's Bandon Dunes or it's Pinehurst or it's Pebble Beach, there's always a great fire pit. And
yep.
After the round, you're sitting around and you're having a toddy and you're telling your stories, and every par save becomes more dramatic and every putt you hold twice as long. And it's become an ingrained part of the game. And so, you know, my longtime great friend Matt Janela and I were building our own media company, and we're calling the Fire Pit Collective because all we want to do is tell great stories about the game, whether it's going to be podcasts, it's going to be video storytelling. All my typing is going to go there. I did cover the Masters for Golf Digest, which is owned by Discovery TV, with whom we have signed a content distribution deal. So it's kind of a handy little marriage for now. But really, we want to grow our own company. We want to do our own thing. And it's going to be kind of a clearinghouse for a lot of great golf content. And we're the bosses. We can do whatever we want. Which, you know, both of us have suffered the tyranny of editors and owners and various point missers and obstructionists. And now we can just have fun and tell it like it is. So we're very excited. We just launched it last month, and we've been scooping up investment capital. And we're about to announce some hires and really launch this thing. So we're we're quite excited.
Good for you, man. I like that a lot. That's the Fire Pit Collective. He is a longtime golf writer. He's a contributor to Golf Digest, and as I mentioned, the recipient of 11 first place awards from the Golf Writers Association of America, Alan Shipnook, my guest. Alan, great job. Really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Always good to talk to you. My man's on it. Always has been. And has come on this show for a number of years. When we come back,